other pressing infrastructure needs. Here's the simple truth. You can't be an American company only when it benefits you. You also have to be an American company when it comes to paying your fair share of taxes. If Wall Street and big corporations don't agree, the next time they need a bailout or some other kind of public assistance, let them go to the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, or Panama and ask those countries for corporate welfare. Reforming the personal income tax. The idea is that all Americans are created equal, and that all of us are entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were, according to the founders, supposed to be self-evident truths. But those foundational notions about what this country is supposed to be all about are seriously imperiled by the grotesque level of wealth and income inequality that exists in America today. If American justice means anything, it means ending tax breaks to the rich and powerful so that we can rebuild the middle class, raise wages, reduce poverty, and create millions of good-paying jobs. It also means implementing a fair and progressive tax code. During the campaign, I proposed raising taxes on the wealthiest 2.1% of American households making over $250,000 a year and individuals with incomes above $200,000. Under this plan, 97.9% of Americans would not see their taxes go up. However, within the top 2.1%, the rates get progressively higher at the top income levels. The top marginal rates would be 37% on income between $250,000 and $500,000, 43% on income between $500,000 and $2 million, 48% on income between $2 million and $10 million. In 2013, only 113 households, the top 0.08%, had income between $2 million and $10 million. 52% on income above $10 million. In 2013, only 113,000 households, just 0.01% of taxpayers, had income exceeding $10 million. During the campaign, I proposed that the new revenue being generated by creating a progressive personal income tax be used to fund a Medicare for All single-payer healthcare system. A progressive estate tax. More than 240 years ago, the founders of our country declared their independence from what they viewed as a tyrannical aristocracy in England. But today's tyrannical aristocracy is no longer a foreign power. It's an American billionaire class that has unprecedented economic and political influence over all of our lives. Unless we reduce skyrocketing wealth and income inequality, unless we end the ability of the super rich to buy elections, the United States will be well on its way to becoming an oligarchic form of society where almost all power rests with the billionaire class. More than a century ago, President Theodore Roosevelt recognized the danger of massive wealth and income inequality and what it meant to the economic and political well-being of the country. In addition to busting up the big trusts of his time, he fought for the creation of a progressive estate tax to reduce the enormous concentrations of wealth that existed during the Gilded Age. The absence of effective state and especially national restraint upon unfair money getting has tended to create a small class of enormously wealthy and economically powerful men whose chief object is to hold and increase their power, the Republican president said. The really big fortune, the swollen fortune, by the mere fact of its size, acquires qualities which differentiate it in kind as well as in degree from what is passed by men of relatively small means. Therefore, I believe in a graduated inheritance tax on big fortunes properly safeguarded against evasion and increasing rapidly in amount with the size of the estate. Roosevelt spoke those words on August 31st, 1910. They are even more relevant today. Since 1916, the estate tax has been a bulwark against an oligarchic form of society. However, as we have seen, the estate tax has been weakened over the years. Strengthening it is one of the fairest ways to reduce wealth inequality, while at the same time raising significant new revenues that the country needs to rebuild the middle class. During the campaign, I proposed restoring the minimum estate size subject to the tax from $5 million to $3.5 million, where it was in 2009. This would only impact the estates of the wealthiest 0.3% of Americans who inherit more than $3.5 million. And along the lines of what Teddy Roosevelt suggested, we should make it graduated to target the bigger estates. 45% for the value of an estate between $3.5 million and $10 million. 50% for the value of an estate between $10 million and $50 million. 55% for the value of an estate in excess of $50 million. We should also implement a 10% surtax on the value of estates above $1 billion to break up the extreme wealth of the 540 billionaires in the United States, the wealthiest 0.0002% of America, and end tax breaks for dynasty trusts. This includes eliminating the so-called grantor-retained annuity trust and the generation skipping tax, whose loopholes have allowed billionaires like Sheldon Adelson and the Walton family, the owners of Walmart, to legally manipulate the rules for trusts passed on from one generation to the next without paying estate or gift taxes, resulting in savings of $100 billion in taxes since 2000. Look, I know estate tax minutia are not exactly sexy, but the point is this. There are all sorts of loopholes that help the wealthiest families avoid paying estate and gift taxes. We must close each and every one of them, including gift tax exclusions and valuation discounts. I come from an agricultural state, so let me dismiss the argument that the estate tax is bad for family farmers. When challenged to find a family farmer who was subject to an estate tax, the Conservative Farm Bureau couldn't. Of course, that doesn't keep it from repeating the myth. In any case, my proposal would protect family farmers by allowing them to lower the value of their farmland by up to $3 million for estate tax purposes through the use of agricultural easements. It would also increase the maximum exclusion for conservation easements to $2 million. Treat capital gains and dividends the same as work. Capital gains and corporate stock dividends are taxed at lower rates than the wages and salaries most of us live on. The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, estimated that 68% of this tax break went to the richest 1% of Americans in 2013. That is why someone like Warren Buffett, the second wealthiest American, is able to pay an effective tax rate that is lower than his secretary's. To his credit, Buffett says, "This is profoundly wrong." We need to enact a real Buffett rule. By repealing the low income tax rates on capital gains and stock dividends for those who make more than $250,000 a year, we should also repeal the exclusion of capital gains on bequests and gifts from taxable income. This exclusion, in effect, subsidizes wealthy families who hold on to assets in order to pass them on to the next generation, increasing the sort of dynastic wealth that is a feature of economic inequality. Limit tax deductions of the top 2%. Our tax code has several complex provisions to limit the benefits of tax breaks for the wealthy, including the alternative minimum tax, AMT, the personal exemption phase-out, PEP, and the limit on itemized deductions. I propose replacing these provisions with a simpler one limiting the tax savings for each dollar of deductions to just 28 cents for high-income households. A new trade policy. We need a new trade policy that creates decent-paying jobs in America and ends the race to the bottom. Corporate America cannot continue to throw American workers out on the streets while they outsource our jobs and enjoy record-breaking profits. One of the major reasons the middle class has been in a 40-year decline, poverty has been increasing, and the gap between the very rich and everyone else has been growing wider, is because we've been losing millions of jobs as a result of our disastrous trade policies. We must do everything possible to stop companies from outsourcing American jobs. The reality is that over the last 35 years, so-called free trade policies have been unrelentingly bad for American workers. Written by corporate America, these rigged agreements have made it far easier for companies to shut down manufacturing plants in the U.S., throw workers out on the street, and move to Mexico, China, and other countries where workers are paid a fraction of what they are in the U.S. You do not need a PhD in economics to understand that while our trade agreements have worked extremely well for huge corporations, they have miserably failed working people. Since 2001, nearly 60,000 manufacturing plants in this country have been shut down and boarded up, and we have lost more than 4.8 million decent-paying manufacturing jobs. Not all of these factories and jobs were lost due to our trade policies, but many of them were. To fully understand what these trade agreements are all about, we should remember what Jack Welch, the former CEO of General Electric, said back in 1998. "Ideally," he said, "you'd have every plant you own on a barge to move with currencies and changes in the economy." What Mr. Welch was saying is that in the CEO's perfect world, companies like his would effortlessly move from country to country, wherever labor was cheapest, taxes were lowest, and environmental protections were weakest. In other words, if the U.S. increased its minimum wage, a company could simply pull up an anchor and ship its jobs to Mexico. If Mexico strengthened its environmental law, no problem, that company would simply move to China. If China banned sweatshops, then the company could just move to Vietnam. Until Vietnam decided to increase taxes, in which case, well, you get the idea. This is the essence of what the race to the bottom is all about, and why millions of Americans are rejecting unfettered free trade. Mr. Welch's analogy of a company on a barge was brutally honest. In this era of free trade, he basically acknowledged that corporations have absolutely no loyalty to the countries where they are based or to the workers they employ. That's exactly what these corporate-backed, corporate-written free trade deals are all about. They really aren't about trade at all. Trade, when structured in a fair manner, can be a driver of increased wages and widely shared prosperity, but free trade agreements aren't fair. Rather, they're all about increasing the profits of multinational corporations that have allegiance only to their bottom line. During the presidential campaign, I met with Americans all over this country who have had their lives torn apart as a result of job-killing trade deals, and I did my best to give voice to these struggling Americans whom the corporate-owned media, one of the biggest cheerleaders of free trade, almost completely ignores. Unbelievably, while trade agreements have an enormous impact on the lives of millions of Americans, they're virtually never discussed on television and rarely discussed in newspapers. According to Media Matters, a nonpartisan media watchdog, as the debate on the disastrous Trans-Pacific Partnership was heating up, not one of the major networks chose to mention this trade agreement on its evening broadcast news programs from August 1, 2013 through May 10, 2015. This includes ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and NBC Nightly News. And with the exception of Ed Schultz at MSNBC, who has since been taken off the air, the cable news networks barely mention the TPP, a trade agreement that encompasses 40% of the global economy. But the workers impacted by trade deals certainly know all about them. In Michigan, I held a press conference with Kim Ward, whose job at American Axle in Lansing was shipped to Mexico along with 1,900 others. As Ms. Ward told me, I loved my job. I was able to provide for my family and put a roof over their heads. We had a good thing going. We raised our family together. Then the company wanted to slash pay in half and cut benefits. The workers went on strike but eventually made concessions. Still, the company moved the plant to Mexico. A lot of lives were destroyed by what happened, and it's not fair. Kim is right. It's not fair. Unfortunately, Kim's story is hardly unique. In fact, it is a reoccurring theme all throughout the Wolverine State. In 1960, Detroit was the richest city in America, and General Motors was the nation's largest private employer, paying union workers a living wage with affordable health care and secure retirement. But as a result of our destructive trade rules and other unfair policies, half of Detroit's auto workers lost their jobs from 1998 to 2011, as GM and Ford moved factory after factory to Mexico. Today, the Motor City is a shell of its former self, and it is one of the poorest cities in America. No city in America has suffered more than Flint, Michigan. Long before Flint's children were poisoned by contaminated drinking water, the city was poisoned by disastrous trade policies. Unfettered free trade and corporate tax loopholes allowed General Motors to eliminate more than 72,000 jobs in Flint when it moved several manufacturing plants to Mexico. Free trade turned this once prosperous middle-class city where residents could own a home, raise a family, and retire in dignity and with security into a place where good jobs are scarce and extreme poverty is high. Today, one quarter of Flint residents have an annual income of less than $15,000, and 65% of its children live in poverty. Of course, Michigan is not alone. In Wisconsin, I visited town after town devastated by major manufacturing plant closures. In Janesville, General Motors shut down its manufacturing plant in 2008, eliminated over 2,800 good-paying jobs, and moved the facility to Celaya, Mexico, where workers are paid one-tenth of what the workers in Janesville made. Another 800 people lost their jobs when Chrysler shut down its engine plant in Kenosha and moved to Saltillo, Mexico. In Indiana, I saw once vibrant and strong manufacturing towns like Gary, South Bend, Muncie, Bloomington, Indianapolis, and Evansville, all littered with abandoned factories and steel mills, sky-high poverty rates, and foreclosed homes. I met with workers manufacturing furnaces for United Technologies who were told that 2,100 of their jobs would soon be shipped to Mexico, where workers are paid just $3 an hour. It turns out the announcement to the workers that they would be losing their jobs was caught on video, and when that video went viral, people from all walks of life caught a glimpse of the callousness by which corporate America shuts down plants and destroys lives. On the video, an executive tells the workers, "It became clear that the best way to stay competitive and protect the business for the long term is to move production from our facility in Indianapolis to Monterrey, Mexico. I want to be clear. This is strictly a business decision. We still have a job to do. We have to take care of what needs to be done every day and do it well, just like we always do." You can't make this stuff up. The people running this company have no shame. United Technologies made a $7 billion profit in 2015 thanks to the hard work of its employees, who were rewarded with the announcement that they would soon lose their jobs because the company had to cut costs to remain competitive. Of course, United Technologies had plenty of money in 2014 to provide its retiring CEO, Louis Scheinwerth, with a golden parachute worth $172 million. This is the kind of corporate greed that is destroying the middle class of this country. A $172 million severance package for the boss while workers are thrown out on the street. And it's happening all over America. In Pennsylvania, I learned about 1,000 workers in Dunmore who lost their jobs in 2001 when Thomson Consumer Electronics moved its television manufacturing plant to Mexicali, Mexico, where workers are paid $4.40 an hour in wages and benefits, less than a third of what the workers in Pennsylvania made. In 2008, Sony shut down the last television factory plant in America in Westmoreland, Pennsylvania, and moved production to a facility in Baja, Mexico. In 2014, Americans purchased over 34 million television sets. Not a single one of them was made in the U.S. In Chicago, we learned that Nabisco was shutting down its manufacturing plant at 73rd and Kedzie and shipping 600 jobs to Mexico, where workers make in 1 week what the workers on the south side of Chicago made in just a couple of hours. In June 2016, the Democratic National Committee's Platform Committee heard heart-wrenching testimony from Michael Smith, a proud father of four children and one of the hundreds of workers who had lost jobs at this plant. Here's what Mr. Smith said. Nabisco built the largest cookie and cracker production facility in the world, in Mexico. They then asked people like me in Chicago to compete with workers in Mexico, where the general minimum wage is just 73 pesos per day or $4.19 per day. We were asked to take a wage and benefit reduction of 60%. But even with this sacrifice, there are 600 less of us working in Chicago as our jobs are moved to a new workforce in central Mexico. A workforce they hired at the factory that they built with the profits we and our families for generations have made for Nabisco. I'm not a number, nor are my family, nor are my neighbors, nor my co-workers, merely numbers. We are, however, victims of this ongoing global snatch and grab that has gutted our community, denied our children a bright future, and made our communities less safe as a result of homelessness and the inability to provide important public services. We owe it to Michael Smith, Kim Ward, the GM workers in Flint, the United Technologies workers, and the millions of others like them who have lost their jobs, to develop trade policies that create jobs in America, not in Mexico and other low-wage countries. And let's be clear. This is a problem that is not limited to the Midwest. It is hitting every corner of our country. When I visited North Carolina, I saw how our trade policies have battered the Tar Heel State, which was a worldwide leader in the manufacturing of furniture, textiles, and apparel. Jobs in these industries once allowed North Carolinians with little education to make a middle-class income at textile mills, furniture factories, and garment shops. This is no longer true today. Since the World Trade Organization, WTO, began phasing out quotas for textile imports, North Carolina has lost over 70% of its textile jobs and 63% of its apparel workers. And since NAFTA, the Tar Heel State has seen half of its manufacturing workforce disappear. In 2008, hundreds of workers making $15 an hour in the small town of Lenoir lost their jobs when Broyhill Furniture moved factories to China, where workers are paid just 70 cents an hour. Median incomes in Wilkes County, another area hard hit by the closure of textile mills, has plummeted by 30% since 2000. Mount Airy, the hometown of Andy Griffith, has lost more than 3,000 textile and apparel jobs since 1999. Former textile workers in this town of 10,000 are now lucky if they get a job paying a fraction of the wages they previously earned. Leviton's light switch factory in Ashe County shipped 211 jobs to Mexico in 2009. While you will rarely hear about this on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox News, unfettered free trade has decimated North Carolina, resulting in the loss of almost 360,000 good-paying jobs. In Kentucky, Mattel shuttered its last U.S. toy manufacturing plant in 2001, shipping 980 jobs to Mexico, China, and other countries in Asia. 13 years later, Fruit of the Loom, owned by Warren Buffett, the second richest person in the U.S., worth more than $68 billion, closed its last U.S. manufacturing plant in Jamestown, outsourcing 600 jobs to Honduras. This one really stung local officials who had just approved a $12 million taxpayer-funded water plant primarily to benefit Fruit of the Loom. How can you reconcile destroying the livelihoods of 600 families? A local county judge wrote to Mr. Buffett at the time. Surely greater profits can't be more important than the lives of people, he wrote, pleading with Mr. Buffett to keep the plant open. Mr. Buffett never responded, and the factory was closed just a few months later. In 1991, Fruit of the Loom was the second largest manufacturing employer in Kentucky with 11,000 workers. Today, this iconic American company no longer employs a single factory worker in the U.S., not one. Out on the West Coast, I visited Anaheim, California, the home of Disneyland, most of whose popular toys are made in sweatshops in China. And by the way, I learned that many of its theme park employees earn wages so low that they're forced to sleep in motels. Of course, not everyone is hurting at Disney. In 2015, the company made $8.4 billion in profits and paid its CEO almost $45 million in total compensation. If you want to know what a rigged economy and corporate greed look like, look no further than this Fortune 500 company. After Anaheim, I visited the port of Los Angeles, where huge container and cargo ships arrive filled to capacity with televisions, computers, bicycles, toys, and other products, all made in China. Sadly, many of these ships return to Asia empty. The situation has become so bad that even the Wall Street Journal, one of the most ardent pro-free trade publications on the planet, reported one of the fastest-growing U.S. exports right now is air. After a surge in container ships left U.S. ports without a single American-made product to be exported abroad. To understand the absurdity of our unfettered free trade policies, just take a trip to one of the many gift shops at our national parks and museums. A few years ago, long before I had considered running for president, I visited the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to do some holiday shopping for my grandkids. What I discovered is that in the gift shop of the premier museum dedicated to celebrating the history of the United States, most of the products offered for sale were not even made in America. It was reflective of where we are as a nation. When bronze-colored busts of U.S. presidents from George Washington to Barack Obama were marked made in China. Unfortunately, this situation was not unique to the National Museum of American History. The same was true in gift shops at the Jefferson Memorial, the Washington Monument, the FDR Memorial, and the Lincoln Memorial. Product after product at these stores were made in China or Honduras or Mexico. The good news is that today, after I raised the issue, those bronze presidential busts are made in America. As a member of Congress and as a senator, not only have I opposed every one of these job-killing free trade agreements, but I'm proud to have stood with workers on picket lines to protect them. And as someone who has been all over this country as part of a presidential campaign and has seen the job destruction that trade deals have caused, I am more committed than ever to reversing these policies. When we talk about unfettered free trade, it is important to understand that these policies have been developed in a bipartisan manner, with the support of both Republican and Democratic presidents. Corporate America spoke, the leaders of both parties responded to their needs, and American workers suffered. These agreements have also been supported by virtually the entire corporate media. Check the editorial pages of every major newspaper in America, and you will find them all pro-free trade. It is astounding how wrong proponents of unfettered free trade have always been. Recall what they have said year after year, trade agreement after trade agreement. In 1993, during the debate over NAFTA, President Bill Clinton promised us that the trade agreement with Mexico and Canada would, create 1 million jobs in the first 5 years. Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, later to become the Republican Senate Majority Leader, promised American firms will not move to Mexico just for lower wages. The ultra-conservative Heritage Foundation told us, virtually all economists agree that NAFTA will produce a net increase of U.S. jobs over the next decade. Unfortunately, President Clinton, Senator McConnell, the Heritage Foundation, and many, many others were way off the mark. Instead of creating 1 million American jobs, the Economic Policy Institute found NAFTA destroyed more than 850,000 American jobs. In fact, every state in the nation has lost jobs as a result of NAFTA. In 1993, the year before NAFTA was implemented, the United States actually had a trade surplus with Mexico of more than $1.6 billion. Since NAFTA was implemented in 1994, the United States has run up a cumulative trade deficit with Mexico of nearly $1 trillion. Last year alone, the trade deficit with Mexico was more than $60 billion as we imported a record-breaking $296 billion in Mexican-made products. By any objective measure, NAFTA has been a complete failure. Yet in 2000, less than 6 years after NAFTA was implemented, most Republicans, too many Democrats, and editorial boards all across the country told us that what we really needed was another unfettered free trade deal, this time with China, an authoritarian communist country almost four times our size. They told us that this trade agreement would create a thriving middle class in China that would purchase all kinds of American-made goods and products. And we were told that this trade deal was not NAFTA. This one would be much different and much better. In fact, President Clinton said that granting China permanent normal trade relations, PNTR, status would be a 100-to-nothing deal for America when it comes to economic consequences. A few months later, Jerry Jasinowski, then head of the National Association of Manufacturers, representing the largest multinational corporations in the world, including ExxonMobil, Intel, Xerox, Dow Chemical, and Procter & Gamble, told us that the Chinese consumers were hungry for the opportunity to buy more American products, and that normalizing trade with China would create hundreds of thousands of good-paying jobs for U.S. workers. A Republican member of Congress from Connecticut assured us that PNTR with China would be the bargain of the century that would bring down the curtain of Chinese protectionism. They could not have been more wrong. PNTR with China has led to the loss of 3.2 million jobs, as American workers have been forced to compete with some of the most desperate workers in the world. Since normalized trade with China was enacted, the U.S. has racked up a cumulative trade deficit with China of more than $3.7 trillion, and our annual trade deficit with that country has more than quadrupled. How could the proponents of free trade been so wrong again? Maybe, just maybe, they were purposely misleading us. Or perhaps some of them were misled by corporate America. But in terms of PNTR with China, it is interesting to see what those in favor of free trade said before the deal passed Congress and what they said after PNTR was signed into law in 2000. On December 6, 2002, Jeffrey Immelt, then CEO of General Electric, said at an investor meeting, "When I'm talking to GE managers, I talk China, 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 China. You need to be there. You need to change the way people talk about it and how they get there. I'm a nut on China. Outsourcing from China is going to grow to $5 billion. We're building a tech center in China. Every discussion today has to center on China. The cost basis is extremely attractive. You can take an 18-cubic-foot refrigerator, make it in China, land it in the United States, and land it for less than we can make an 18-cubic-foot refrigerator today ourselves. That's what PNTR with China was really all about. It was not about creating American jobs. It was about allowing companies like General Electric to ship decent-paying American jobs to China. During the campaign, I was asked by the editorial board of the New York Daily News to name a corporation that was destroying the moral fabric of America. The company I named was General Electric. In my view, General Electric's policies of outsourcing jobs to low-wage countries and avoiding U.S. taxes were the epitome of corporate greed and a model that other companies followed. Apparently, my comments did not sit well with Mr. Immelt, who in a rebuttal piece in the Washington Post insisted that I was missing the point. A week later, Peter Knowlton, Andrew Dinkelker, and Eugene Elk, the General President, General Secretary, Treasurer, and Director of Organization for the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, the UE, responded to Mr. Immelt in a letter to the editor. Here is what they wrote. As officers of a national union that has represented GE workers for 80 years, we can affirm from our union's experience and knowledge of GE that Mr. Sanders is right. Since 1999, GE has reduced its U.S. workforce by 37%, and since 2008, the company has closed more than 50 factories and facilities in the United States. In 1995, 68% of GE's total employment was in the United States. By 2015, it was 38%. For a decade, GE has pursued a policy it calls the competitive wage, aimed at cutting the wage rates of its manufacturing workers in half, even as the pay of Mr. Immelt and other executives soars higher into the stratosphere. Mr. Immel claims that GE is in the business of building real things and generating real growth for our economy. We fail to see how destroying communities, turning good jobs into poverty jobs, and depriving our retired employees of health care benefits generates real growth in anything but the company's profits and executive pay. General Electric is hardly alone. Just 3 years after the PNTR deal, and 2 years after China was admitted into the WTO, the National Labor Committee documented grievous labor conditions in that country. They found that Walmart had nearly 4,500 factories in China where workers were paid as little as 13 cents an hour and worked as many as 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. While I expect that these labor conditions are better now than they were in 2003, the reality is that there are millions of Chinese workers who are still being exploited making products for Walmart. So here's the bottom line. Walmart does virtually all of its manufacturing in China. In the United States, they pay starvation wages, forcing many of them to go on government programs like food stamps and Medicaid in order to survive. And then, not surprisingly, it turns out that the Walton family, now worth over $130 billion, is the wealthiest family in America. And let's be clear, blue-collar workers aren't the only ones who have been hurt by free trade. One of the things free trade supporters have told us is that while we may lose some blue-collar jobs, PNTR with China and other trade agreements will create millions of high-paying white-collar technology and computer jobs, the jobs of the future. Well, that also turned out to be wrong. And again, the CEOs knew it. On October 10, 2003, the Wall Street Journal reported, Andy Grove, the founder of Intel, predicted that the U.S. will lose the bulk of its information technology jobs to China and India over the next decade. Given cost and productivity pressures, the Santa Clara-based semiconductor maker reluctantly has no choice but to continue sending work abroad, Grove said. Of course, Mr. Grove was right. Since 1997, we have lost over 43% of computer jobs, ranging from the production of semiconductors to medical equipment. That's more than the 31% loss in our overall manufacturing employment. And just think about all the innovations U.S. companies have made in technology. The iPad, the iPhone, the iPod, IBM computers, Dell computers, the Microsoft Xbox, big screen TVs, and none of these American inventions are manufactured in the U.S. Most of them are manufactured in China. In fact, according to a December 15, 2010 article, The Wall Street Journal, Apple's iPhone, one of the best-selling U.S. technology products, actually added $1.9 billion to the U.S. trade deficit with China in 2009. Michael Marks, then CEO of Flextronics, a company that manufactures Xbox consoles for Microsoft and computer hardware, told Business Week in 2003, "All electronics, hardware, manufacturing is going to China. Our employment base is actually at a record high, about 100,000. We've done this by cutting the workforce in high-cost locations and adding in low-cost places. We put a lot of consumer products in Asia, where they belong in the first place. China has been the hottest location. We have 35,000 there. For example, we moved all of the production of Microsoft's Xbox consoles from Mexico to China." On October 21st, 2004, John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, said, "What we're trying to do is outline an entire strategy of becoming a Chinese company." All of these comments were made just within a few years of the PNTR trade deal with China. The reality is that PNTR had nothing to do with creating high-tech jobs in America, any more than it did with creating blue-collar jobs here. Rather, it just made it easier to ship both high-tech and blue-collar jobs abroad. 12 years after the passage of PNTR with China, there was a Democratic president in the White House who had campaigned on rewriting NAFTA and opposing trade agreements negotiated by George W. Bush. Here is what then-candidate Barack Obama told the AFL-CIO in Philadelphia on April 2, 2008. "What I refuse to accept is that we have to sign trade deals like the South Korea agreement that are bad for American workers. What I oppose, and what I have always opposed, are trade deals that put the interests of multinational corporations ahead of interests of American workers, like NAFTA and CAFTA, and permanent normal trade relations with China. And I'll also oppose the Colombia Free Trade Agreement if President Bush insists on sending it to Congress, because the violence against unions in Colombia would make a mockery of the very labor protections that we have insisted be included in these kinds of agreements. So you can trust me when I say that whatever trade deal we negotiate when I'm president will be good for American workers, and that they'll have strong labor and environmental protections that we'll enforce." Unfortunately, once in office, President Obama urged Congress to approve the exact same deals that he opposed as a candidate. In 2012, he insisted that the South Korea Free Trade Agreement would create at least 70,000 American jobs and reduce the trade deficit. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce went even further by saying it would create some 280,000 jobs. They were both wrong. Since its implementation, we have lost over 100,000 jobs to South Korea, and our trade deficit with that country has gone up by about 115%. President Obama promised that mechanisms in the Colombia Free Trade Agreement would prevent the assassinations, murders, and horrific violence against trade unionists that had gone on for so long in that country. Yet, according to the AFL-CIO, since the agreement was signed, workers attempting to exercise their rights have suffered at least 1,466 threats and acts of violence, including 955 death threats and 99 assassinations. Just think about that for a moment. If we found out that 99 CEOs had been assassinated in Colombia, do you think we would continue to have a free trade agreement with that country? I don't think so. President Obama is a friend of mine. I've worked with him on many issues, but on the issue of trade, he has been dead wrong. And today he's wrong again for working with corporate America and advocating for the passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The simple reality is that the TPP is based on the same flawed trade model as NAFTA. The TPP should be called what it is, NAFTA on steroids. One recent study estimates that TPP would mean pay cuts for all but the wealthiest 10% of Americans, making the growing problem of income inequality even worse. Another study estimates that TPP would lead to the elimination of nearly 500,000 American jobs and a significant reduction in economic growth. Albert Einstein once said, "The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results." Passing the TPP would be insane. Unfettered free trade has failed us in the past and it will fail us in the future. But this time, with the TPP, the consequences could be even direr. The TPP continues an approach toward trade that forces Americans to compete against desperate workers overseas. In Vietnam, the minimum wage is just 65 cents an hour. Even worse, the TPP would give Malaysia privileged access to the U.S. market. This is a country where migrant workers in the electronics industry are working as modern-day slaves. Some have even had their passports and wages confiscated and are unable to return to their own countries. It is bad enough to force U.S. workers to compete with low-wage labor. They should not have to compete with no-wage labor. When analyzing a free trade agreement like the TPP, it's important to take a look at who is for it and who is against it. Large, multinational corporations that have already outsourced millions of good-paying American jobs to China, Mexico, Bangladesh, and other low-wage countries are among TPP's biggest supporters. They think TPP is a great idea because they understand it will allow them to accelerate efforts to hire cheap labor abroad. Wall Street investors and large pharmaceutical companies also love the TPP because their global profits will increase dramatically if this agreement is passed. On the other hand, every union in this country, representing more than 12 million American workers, is opposed to the TPP. Because they all understand it will lead to the loss of decent-paying jobs and will depress wages. Virtually every major environmental organization also opposes TPP, understanding that it will make it easier for multinational corporations to pollute and degrade the environment. Many major religious groups oppose TPP because they know it would reward some of the worst violators of human rights in the world. The TPP, like other free trade agreements, advances a very dangerous provision that undermines democracy and allows multinational corporations to override governmental decisions designed to protect public health, labor rights, and the environment. This provision, called the Investor-State Dispute Settlement System, allows a foreign corporation to sue a government if it believes that its expected future profits would be threatened. This is no small issue. It is a major step toward the complete corporatization of the world economy, where corporate profits are explicitly made more important than the health and well-being of the people of the world. As an example of how this investor-state dispute resolutions works, thanks to NAFTA, TransCanada is suing the U.S. in an international tribunal for $15 billion in damages because President Obama did the right thing by rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline. The president's decision, made in the interest of the nation, was based on his concern that the pipeline would accelerate climate change. However, according to the Investor-State Dispute Resolution System, within NAFTA, TransCanada's right to make a profit might just supersede President Obama's desire to protect the planet. As the Sierra Club co-wrote along with other environmental groups, The Obama administration's rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline was an execution of its legal right done amidst widespread evidence that the project would hurt communities and the environment. It is therefore egregious that under NAFTA, TransCanada can demand billions of dollars for a sound policy decision that is squarely within the U.S. law. And TransCanada isn't the first company to use the investor-state dispute settlement system to extort money from countries that had the temerity to pass laws or regulations impacting corporate profits. In 2012, a World Bank tribunal ordered the country of Ecuador to pay a $1.7 billion fine to Occidental Petroleum for canceling an oil contract in the Amazon for environmental reasons. This penalty was later reduced to $980 million, which is still more than 1% of Ecuador's entire GDP. A French waste management firm, Veolia, has used the investor-state dispute settlement process to sue Egypt for $110 million because it increased the minimum wage and improved labor laws. In other words, Egypt's crime was trying to improve life for its low-wage workers. Vattenfall, a Swedish energy company, sued Germany for $5 billion over its decision to phase out nuclear power after the Fukushima disaster. Do we really want to tell governments all around the world, including ours, that if they pass legislation protecting the well-being of their citizens or protecting their environment, they could be subject to substantial fines? Of course not. But that's exactly what is happening today, and TPP would make it only worse. Moreover, the TPP would substantially raise the price of prescription drugs for some of the most desperate people in the world. Pharmaceutical companies are doing everything they can to extend their monopoly and market exclusivity rights to make it harder for people to access lower-cost generic drugs, even if it means that thousands will die because they cannot afford the drugs they need. According to Oxfam International, more than half of the HIV/AIDS patients in Vietnam, over 125,000 people, could lose access to the medications they need to survive if the TPP is implemented. Doctors Without Borders has said, the TPP agreement is on track to become the most harmful trade pact ever for access to medicines in developing countries. Enough is enough. We need to do everything we can to reject TPP. To do otherwise would be insanity. The goal of U.S. trade policy must be to create good-paying jobs in this country and to lift living standards around the world. We can no longer continue with an approach that leads to a race to the bottom for American workers and huge profits for multinational corporations. Over the past 35 years, trade agreement after trade agreement has not only failed to create jobs, but has instead contributed to unprecedented and unsustainable trade deficits. The net loss of nearly 5 million U.S. manufacturing jobs, millions of lost service jobs, and flat-out or declining median wages. Economists across the political spectrum, including the pro-NAFTA Peterson Institute for International Economics, which estimated that 39% of the growth in U.S. wage inequality is attributable to our disastrous trade deals, agree that free trade has contributed to rising U.S. income inequality. U.S. manufacturing workers who lose jobs to trade and find new employment are typically forced to take significant pay cuts. 3 out of every 5 displaced manufacturing workers who were rehired in 2014 took home smaller paychecks, and 1 out of 3 lost more than 20% of his or her income. We've got to turn this around. American jobs must no longer be our number one export. We must not only defeat the TPP, we must fundamentally renegotiate our failed trade agreements, including NAFTA, PNTR with China, and other existing trade pacts. As part of a new trade policy, we must eliminate the incentives baked into our current trade and tax agreements that make it easier for multinational corporations to ship jobs overseas. Corporations should not be able to get a tax deduction for the expenses involved in moving factories abroad and throwing American workers out on the street. Instead of providing federal tax breaks, contracts, grants, and loans to corporations that outsource jobs, we need to support the small businesses that are creating good jobs in America. The backbone of a growing economy is made up of small businesses on Main Street all over America, not giant corporations and huge financial institutions on Wall Street. As big multinational corporations have downsized and outsourced millions of jobs overseas, small businesses have been doing the exact opposite. We need to help those companies that are creating jobs in this country, not in China. It is clear to me that the American people want their tax dollars used to put their fellow Americans back to work. They want government contracts going to American companies, not companies abroad. That's the way it's done in every other country, and there's no reason why it can't be done that way here as well. We must expand and not eviscerate Buy American, Buy Local, and other government policies that will increase jobs in the U.S. This includes service sector contracts that will stop the offshoring of government call centers and data processing facilities to the Philippines and other countries. Moreover, we need to make sure that the strong and binding labor, environmental, and human rights standards are written into the core text of all trade agreements. At a minimum, this means that all countries must comply with the standards of the International Labor Organization, the Multilateral Environmental Agreements, and the United Nations Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We must add to the core text of every U.S. trade agreement enforceable rules against currency cheating, which allows countries to unfairly dump their products in this country and make our exports more expensive abroad. And we need to establish a simple rule that food may be imported into the United States only if it meets or exceeds U.S. standards with respect to safety, pesticide use, inspections, packaging, and labeling. We must also take a hard look at the concept of a social tariff. It is inherently unfair for American workers to have to compete against countries with abysmally low wages, minimal environmental standards, and poor records on human rights. Reforming Wall Street. Today, the six major financial institutions in this country have almost $10 trillion in assets, equivalent to nearly 60% of our entire GDP. They issue more than two-thirds of all credit cards, underwrite more than 35% of all mortgages, hold 95% of all financial derivatives, and control more than 40% of all bank deposits. Meanwhile, their business model is based on fraud. It's time for real Wall Street reform. Greed, fraud, dishonesty, and arrogance. These are the words that best describe the reality of Wall Street today. Fortunately, the American people are catching on. They understand that there is something profoundly wrong when a handful of billionaires on Wall Street wield extraordinary power and influence over the political and economic life of our country. They understand that Congress does not regulate Wall Street. It is Wall Street that regulates Congress. And the reason for that is simple. Not a single industry in America has contributed more to congressional campaigns and political parties than the financial sector. None. Since the 1990s, the financial services industry has spent billions of dollars on lobbying and campaign contributions to get Congress to deregulate Wall Street, repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, and eliminate consumer protection laws. They spent this money to get the government off their backs, promising to show the American people how much more innovative and efficient a deregulated financial sector would be. Well, they sure showed the American people. In 2008, Wall Street, the largest unregulated gambling casino in the history of the world, crashed and precipitated the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. This crash caused incalculable harm to tens of millions of Americans and people throughout the world. In fact, Wall Street greed nearly destroyed the U.S. and global economies. the 2008 crash. As a result of the financial meltdown of 2008, more than 9 million American jobs were destroyed. Real unemployment skyrocketed to more than 17%, as more than 27 million workers were unemployed, underemployed, or had stopped looking for work altogether. The American dream of home ownership turned into a nightmare of foreclosure for millions of households, as more and more people could not afford to pay their mortgages. This was bound to happen. For years, financial predators received fat commissions from lenders for steering Americans into the riskiest subprime mortgage imaginable. No documentation, no job, no income, no problem. And then the banks bundled those mortgages over and over again into almost worthless and unregulated derivatives until the house of cards collapsed. By the time the dust settled, the housing meltdown had led to 15 million foreclosures and a huge spike in homelessness. And a third of the remaining homeowners were underwater, owing more on their mortgages than their homes were worth. It got so bad that thousands of Americans set up tent cities in Sacramento, Fresno, Tampa Bay, and Reno because they had no place to live. Millions more lived in cars or on a friend's couch. As a result of the Wall Street crash, Americans lost more than $13 trillion in personal wealth, shattering retirement dreams, wiping out life savings, and making it impossible for families to afford to send their kids to college. And while the crisis caused enormous economic pain in every corner of the country, African American and Latino families were hardest hit, because they were disproportionately targeted with subprime mortgages, many of which were designed to fail. It is no accident that minorities were 70% more likely to lose their homes to foreclosure than were white Americans.